Wednesday House Call is presented by Robillard Hearing Centers. Hearingisbelieving.com.
CFRA.
Get real, Kevin, because when you feel like a dirtbag, it's because you're a dirtbag, right? So just own it. Just say it out loud. I am a dirtbag.
Dirtbag? I don't think that guy's a real doctor.
Don't use that word. It sickens me.
Here you go. There's your imported Mexican spring water. Agua de leche.
That was a very classy product. High-end packaging.
It's Mexican water, Bert. You were selling the promise of diarrhea for $3 a bottle.
Kids, today we have to talk about Krusty Brand Chew Goo Gum-like substance. We knew it contained spider eggs, but the Hanta virus, well, that really came out of left field. So, if any of you have experienced numbness or comas, send proof of purchase and $5 to Antidum, P.O. Box 14.
Any questions? Yes, Bart's weird friend.
Will you be my dad?
You got a father. He's just a dud. Next question. Yes, the girl Bart has a crush on.
Do you think I could grow up to be a doctor?
Hey, this was supposed to be about me. Now, any other questions?
No, I'm no Superman.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Wednesday House Calls. Yeah, that is the sign of Wednesday House Calls. Rod Corbett sitting in for Rob this week. Dr. Dworkin, Dr. Barry Dworkin in the studio. You bust a gut at one of those. You okay?
It's funny.
It's hysterical. Chris does a great job in that week after week. You know, not many people get an intro like that. So. It is Wednesday House Calls. The time of the week on the afternoon edition where we take your calls. If you have a medical question for Dr. Dworkin, let me give you the numbers. 521-8255, 521-TALK, star 580. That's a free call if you're on the Bell Mobility System. And the toll-free number, 1-800-580-CFRA, 580-2372. And Barry, we have some people waiting to talk to you already. So right. We'll jump right in. We'll go right to the phones, go down to Oxford Mills, and let's welcome Marty to the show.
Hi there.
Hi.
I have Meniere's disease, which I'm able to control fairly well with diuretic and watching my sodium intake.
Good.
But, occasionally it flares up and I have minor episodes. And when that happens, I go on the internet and find out what the latest research is.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been noticing lately there's some discussion about chiropractic medicine and manipulating the upper cervical spine and how that might alleviate some of the symptoms. And I'm just wondering if you have heard of that or have an opinion on it.
It's unlikely to do anything, and the reason is more for anatomical reasons. The area, the nerves that supply the ear, the what we call sensory neural areas, is your eighth cranial nerve. Your eighth cranial nerve comes off of your brainstem, which is way up in the neck. I mean, really getting close to what we call the foramen magnum, which is the big hole in the skull that allows your essentially your brainstem to come through and your spinal cord. So manipulating areas below that is not going to have any specific action on those nerves. They are literally shrouded. The nerves that come out of the brainstem move forward towards where the ear is.
Right.
And so you can't manipulate that area. It's just too well protected.
Okay.
So I don't know what mechanism they're proposing that would offer evidence that would do something for you.
Okay. But
just from an anatomical standpoint, you know, if we're saying, you know, that the mechanism is, you know, the eighth cranial nerve, you get vertigo, you get ringing in the ears, you get, you know, dizziness from time to time and hearing loss. Well, those are usually nerve conduction problems. And so if it's the nerve that's affected, you know, you can't get to that nerve by manipulating it in the neck.
Okay.
Sorry.
Keep researching.
All right.
Marty, thanks
All
for
right,
calling.
Marty. Thanks for calling.
Best of luck. Smith Falls now. Let's welcome Vera to the show. Good afternoon, Vera.
Sarah. Okay.
I apologize.
I had a question about cold laser treatments for knees, backs, things like that. Have you heard of this?
The only cold laser treatment I've heard of is the device that they use to try to promote weight loss or reducing fat accumulation around the abdomen or other areas of the body. But for what purpose would they be using cold lasers? Like, what is it they are claiming?
it says it's FDA approved for knee pain, mm-hmm. And there's some popular laser treatable conditions include tendonitis, tennis elbow, I think that's the same thing, mm-hmm. Knee pain, Achilles tendon,
right.
Low back, and can I give you a name?
Sure.
Theralase.
Theralase. I'd have to look that up to provide you with some information about that, because I don't want to opine on a particular thing without knowing what's being recommended or where the evidence is. But you have to remember that when the FDA approves something, it's not necessarily they can approve a device in terms of saying this doesn't cause very much harm, but they may not be approving it for a particular modality of treatment. So we have to be careful about that as well. Depending on the websites and the people that are providing this, a lot of times what the websites will say they'll claim that there's evidence, but when you look deeper into it, it's very hard to find the clinical studies that actually show that devices work. I'm not saying that this one doesn't do that, and again, I'm not going to render an opinion one way or the other, because that would be unfair, given I haven't read up on what they've claimed and if there is any evidence for it. But just the questions that go through my mind with anything, it could be a device, it could be a medication. It's always, where is the evidence? What kind of studies were done? What people were used in those studies? Is it reflective of the general population? Is it reflective of athletes? How long does it take to do the treatment? What follow-up studies were done? How long does it last? If it does help, is it a permanent solution? Are there relapses? So those are the questions I would have for any specific thing, and not just the laser. And so that's what I would say to you right now in terms of looking at this, because a lot of times when people are, you know, some people are really looking for help, that they've tried all kinds of other things and it doesn't work. And so when something else comes along that claims to help them for that problem, it's very tempting. And that particular situation may lead someone to make a decision that costs them a lot of money. And at times people are taken advantage of because they're vulnerable. And someone, you know, history is filled with this kind of situation where there's always somebody selling snake oil. Again, I don't know about this. I'd have to look this up. But it just from the initial impression, using lasers to treat tendons, I don't know if that actually helps heal up the tendons. I'd have to look that up. If it did, I'd say that's great. You know, that certainly gives an option to people. But I haven't seen very much of it being used around, and there, especially for orthopedic surgeons and therapists, they would use something like that if they saw that it was very effective.
So be careful here.
So I would be careful. I'll look it up to see
It's being offered by a local chiropractor.
Yeah, but you got to be careful, right? Yeah. People can offer all kinds of things, but you have to see whether this has become a standard of care.
Okay.
That is, if there is precedent for lots of use of this, because again, when someone is offering the procedure and they are and they're charging for it and they're recommending it, there's a conflict of interest, right? And they may be doing this for all the right reasons, but it's still a conflict of interest, and so you have to be careful that you're separating the promotion from the actual evidence.
So, Sarah, so be careful. I do want to get one more call in before we have to take a break.
Okay.
I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to go down to Bill now. You are listening to the Wednesday House Calls with Dr. Barry Dworkin. If you have a medical question, 521-TALK, 521-8255. And good afternoon, Bill.
Good afternoon. I can hardly hear you, gentlemen.
Oh.
I'm questioning... I'd like to question the doctor on a process called chelation therapy.
Yes.
I'm a person who has had it. My cardiologist in Montreal here couldn't get my blood pressure down, and after 15 chelation treatments in Toronto, everything dropped to normal, and I'm feeling great. And every time I go to Toronto, I have one or two little sessions, and it keeps me dancing.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that surprised me, too, my doctor who takes care of me for prostate problems was amazed to see that my test for cancer in that area. EPA or something?
Are you talking about the stuff that they're using for the chelation?
No, I'm talking about my doctor who takes care of me for right. For that. There's something to do with, there's A in there, but it's anyway. It's a measure of how well you're doing in that department.
Okay.
And everything seems to have gone to normal. Plus, there've been side effects that I didn't expect. I can lean over, bend over, and pick up a dime today without.
Bill, if you could hear me, I just want to warn you. We're going to run out of time here. Do you have a question for Dr. Dworkin? Okay.
So the question is, doctor, why don't we see this in general medicine today, where a doctor can chelate you and clean out your veins as opposed to, inserting stents?
Well, the reason is that when you look at chelation therapy is designed primarily to remove calcium and heavy metals from your body. Chelation therapy was originally used to treat people who were exposed to toxic metal levels, so chromium and lead and all these other things. And so chelation therapy would take those compounds out. The issue, though, with regards to calcium is that you can use chelation therapy to remove calcium. Problem is that your bones act as a reservoir for calcium. So as much calcium as you take out by chelation, your bones will release that calcium back into your bloodstream. So we have to be very careful with regards to chelation therapy, not to generalize its use for everybody, because there isn't the evidence to support that. One person, I'm glad that it helped you, but one person responding does not mean that it will apply to everybody. And the studies that have been done so far to date have not shown very much effectiveness for the treatment of cardiovascular disease or high blood pressure. Glad it helped them. At least the claim is it helped them. But again, looking at all the clinical trials that are done, there isn't much evidence to support it. And so we have to be very careful not to do invasive procedures on people, and chelation therapy is an invasive procedure on everyone without the evidence that it will provide a benefit.
There you go, Bill. There's your answer. Thanks very much for giving us a shout from Montreal this afternoon. We're going to take a quick break. If you are waiting to get on, we will get you on the show to speak to Dr. Dworkin.
So my doctor looks at me and says, you should probably drop a couple pounds there, Brian. Thank you. Only your doctor has carte blanche on insults. He just insults you for a while, and then you pay him for the insults on the way out. Well, you should lose some weight, and those moles are looking pretty weird. All right, how much for that, doc? When can we get together again? Big fat mole man walking out of your office. Thanks for the confidence boost. I'm off to the Macy's Day Parade. Grab a rope! What does he care? You're big and you're ugly. Next.
Wednesday House Calls on 580 CFRA. Dr. Dworkin in the studio with us. We have, almost a full house, so we're going to go right to the phones. A lot of calls outside the city this afternoon. Nice to see. Down in bars. Welcome, Wayne.
Hi there. How you doing?
Fine, thanks.
Doc, I had a terrible slip, I guess, 2 months ago, and dislocated my knee to a point where it wouldn't go back together for quite some time, and consequently the nerve got damaged. The orthopedic surgeon, give him credit, I think he's doing a great job, said that my nerve looked like it got hit by a hammer a couple times.
Yeah.
And they thought that it coming back was like 0 to 50.
Mm-hmm.
He's got me on pregambling.
Right.
And I was just wondering if there's anything else I could take.
Now, what dose are you taking of that? Like how much are you taking of the pregabalin?
I'm not quite sure, but I'm taking it 3 times a day. I think it's 10 milligrams.
Usually the smallest dose is 25.
Okay, then it must be that.
Yeah, so that's a very low dose. Right? Yes. The maximum dose for pregabalin is, and the brand name for that is called Lyrica, and it's the only one that's available. It doesn't come as generic right now. Is up to 300 milligrams twice a day. So it really, right now you're taking, if it's the 25s, so you're taking 75 milligrams in total. And if you're not getting adequate pain relief from that, you certainly have a large range within which you can increase the dose. Ideally, you like to try to increase the dose of one medication instead of adding other ones on, just to try and reduce more potential for side effects and interactions. And the pregabalin actually does work very well to help control, especially nerve-type pain. It does work well. You just may have to increase the dose and speak to your physician about that. The side effect of increasing the dose can make you a bit more tired and sleepy, but it tends to work quite well. I know I took that after my knee surgery, and it worked so well that I did not have to use any narcotic medications, no codeines or morphines or anything like that.
Yeah, I am taking extra strength Advil as well.
Yeah, you can combine a lot of things. So the safer things to combine are if you're using the pregabalin, the Advil is okay. You have to be careful about your stomach. But the other is using, there are different strengths of acetaminophen. So that's Tylenol, acetaminophen. You can get the generic acetaminophen, and they sell them as 650 milligram capsules or tablets.
Yes.
And taking two of those is every 8 hours or so, in conjunction with everything else, can also help manage the pain a bit for you. I would be very careful about starting to add in narcotic medications and other painkiller type medications, because they don't tend to work very well, especially for that kind of pain, nerve pain. It doesn't work very well for that. And I'd be hesitant to suggest to use it when it looks like you still have a lot of, as I said, a lot of range with the pregabalin to try to see if that helps control that pain for you.
Well, I didn't know I could increase that. I'll talk to my physician about that. But I kind of lost the control of my foot. It's kind of like I had a drop foot, sorry.
Yeah, so it sounds like the peroneal nerve. That's a nerve that runs on the side. It's on the outside of the leg, right? Is that where you had the damage?
Well, they told me when they took 3 hours to... on the operation table to rebuild my knee, and they told me they pulled out the nerve and it looked like it got hit by a hammer several times, and they didn't think it was ever going to come back. I just thought maybe there's something else I could do to help it come back.
Now, this injury was how long ago?
8 weeks ago.
Okay. You still have some time, Wayne, before a decision is made regarding how well that nerve will recover. The positive thing is if the nerve was not cut, that is, if it was crushed but not cut, nerves can sometimes grow back when that happens.
Yeah.
It can take a long time, especially if it was at the level of your knee. You're talking about, 50 centimeters or longer of distance between the knee and your foot. And that can amount to, 300, 400, 500 days for that nerve to regenerate.
That long, over a year.
It can take a long time.
Wow.
So that's why I wouldn't, I would still keep some hope on this, because it's still too early to know whether this is better. And there are tests that can be done sort of in the middle of your recovery. So, 50, 60, 80 days from now, they can do a test on your leg and measure how well the nerve actually conducts electricity to see if it is repairing itself. So there is that aspect as well. So I would still hold out hope. The surgeons are giving you a worst case scenario, but that's what they should do. And I actually encourage them I agree with them for doing that, because you don't want to give anybody any false interpretation.
No, I think they're the greatest.
So, but with nerve injuries where the nerve has not been cut, and being very clear on this, where the nerve was not cut in half, where it was still intact, but it was just squashed, they can sometimes come back. And so I would keep thinking about that and monitor as you go. It will take a long time. So even next month, you may not see anything happen, because that's only another 30 days out of the 300 or 400 that need to pass before that nerve can repair itself.
There you go.
If it does.
I hope that...
All right. Thanks very much. Appreciate that.
You're very welcome,
thanks, Wayne.
Wayne.
Best of luck. So early days for Wayne.
It's very early. 8 weeks after that kind of knee trauma, it really, you have to give the limb time to heal up.
We wish them the best on there. Let's go down to Canada now. Akbar, welcome to the show.
Hello, good afternoon. Afternoon. Dr. Dworkin.
Good afternoon.
I'm calling on behalf of a friend who was involved in a very massive accident. And what happened is, he was 3 days in coma. And after about 10 days or so, they found that, his half the side was paralyzed.
Okay.
And he had lost his speech. And after 3 days after that, he regained his speech. And since then, you know, he has still half paralyzed, a massive amount of backache that does not go away.
Mm-hmm.
He feels his head is spinning all the time. He gets profuse sweating. He has had a few falls.
Mm-hmm.
And they're giving him various medication, but nothing seems to reduce his pain, and his, he has lost his speech again about 4 months ago.
Right.
He's not receiving any rehab training or speech therapy training or anything of that sort, just medication at the moment and going to see a psychiatrist. And they are saying there's no cure for it, in a sense. It's all in the head. Like he received shock
mm-hmm.
as a result of accident, and there's nothing they can do.
But did he have brain damage in this injury? Was there evidence of bleeding in the skull or pressure buildup or where the brain itself was damaged? Was there anything?
It doesn't look like it, because they had the two MRIs
mm-hmm.
and both of them did not show any problems.
Okay, so what they're saying is that the actual trauma from the accident has caused him to essentially freeze up, where he's just not able to function, and they can't find any reason why he's paralyzed. So they're saying that he should be able to move, but he's not able to move. Is that what they're saying?
That's correct.
Yeah, there are psychiatric syndromes that produce that, where you have these what's called somatic, which means body. Effects where a person can be paralyzed or yeah. parts of their body don't work because of severe emotional trauma or shock. And that can happen. Seeing a psychiatrist, again, if they've ruled out, and I think you've been very clear about this, is that they've ruled out any physical ailment or disease process or damage that could cause that. And so this, and the reason there's no rehab yet is because they need to have a diagnosis in terms of psychiatric illness of what
right.
this is. And if you have a diagnosis, then you can apply a particular therapy. So I think...
What about, massive headaches and backaches and sweating?
That I can't explain, right?
It seems like a psychiatrist is the doctor that he should be seeing.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's that. And if they haven't found any specific damage, right? He's probably feeling all these things. This is not an imagined thing. The question is there damage to illustrate or show that where the pain is coming from? If they're not able to find that, if there's no anatomical explanation of where the body was injured and the pain that results from that, then we're stuck, because you can't just give somebody something without actually having evidence
yeah.
that where the damage is.
But then they're giving him medications of various sorts.
Right, I know.
Anaflexin and
they're giving him things for pain, because he's stating that he has pain. But the problem is that when you don't have a diagnosis, a lot of times the medications may not do what they're supposed to do, because you don't. Usually, if you have a diagnosis, you say, okay, for that diagnosis, we know that these particular medications work. When you don't have a diagnosis, it ends up being more of guesswork to see what would help.
And the nearest they've come to a diagnosis is in what's called inversion or something.
Right. Yeah, and that's a psychiatric condition. And so
I see.
And I really think at this point, you know, it's going to require asking the psychiatrist, when he sees a psychiatrist, to make a diagnosis if they can. And then from that would come specific treatments. It's not irreparable, but it sounds like your friend has a long journey ahead of him.
And Akbar, we want to take one more call here if we can before we run out of time. But
yeah,
it seems like it
one
seems...
quick one, that the fact that he had lost speech and then he regained speech and he has lost it again.
Right, that would go for psychiatric illness. Because if there was something in the brain that caused a loss of speech, they would see that in the brain. And the fact they did two MRIs, there wasn't that, means that you're dealing likely with more of a psychiatric condition. At least from the information that's being provided.
So Akbar, he is seeing the proper physician, and you sound like a great friend. So I'm sure he's going to need those if it's a lengthy recovery,
right.
as you say, Dr. Dworkin. I want to get one more call in. Some people have been waiting patiently. George, good afternoon,
Hello.
Sir.
Hi.
Hi, doctor.
Hi there.
Listen, I'm 83 years old.
Yeah.
And I had open heart surgery 37 years ago, triple bypass.
Okay.
At St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto.
Okay.
Since then, I've been fine, except in 2006, I had a very bad heart attack, and I never expected to live.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a defibrillator and a pacemaker in
my
chest. Now, the pacemaker, I don't feel it, but when I have a problem with the other one.
Yeah.
Oh, you probably understand, you know, what it's like.
You get a little jolt.
Oh, got a hell of a jolt.
Yeah.
But you know something, I'm 83 now, and I'm pretty young for my age. Like, you know, I get around good, except I can't drive. I don't drive anymore.
Right.
But the only question I have, I go in about every 6 months to the defibrillator clinic.
Right.
And it'll be 7 years this June since I've had them installed.
Okay.
Now, does that seem a long time, or depending on whether the batteries are used?
Yeah,
or
I mean,
not?
Barry, we have about half a minute. I'm just going to warn you here.
These devices, George, they usually know the lifespan of them, and some of them can be recharged, and the batteries can be recharged. Some have batteries that are recharged without having to connect it. They do it by induction. So there are different ways for that. But it's a great question. You don't want it to run out of juice, that's for right? So
hello, George,
they would not have you retain the device without knowing its lifespan would be. And it likely, if they haven't said anything, it's likely because they know that it's going to continue to work for quite some time.
There you go. And George, that's a great story. You're a lucky man. I wish you all the best. And that was Wednesday House Call. On 580 CFRA, Dr. Barry Dworkin was my guest. Barry, thanks very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. My pleasure.